You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
How are you going, Marcus?
Pretty good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, really, really good. My voice is a bit crap right now because obviously it's flu season, everyone's been getting sick, but it's not COVID, so thank God I'm not going through that again. Couldn't do it.
Good.
What have we got in Dear Science today? What's our first topic?
Okay, so you may have seen in the news that astrophysicists or astronomers have released another picture of a black hole. There was a famous one published, I think, 2019. The first ever image of a black hole, and that was a black hole at the center of a giant galaxy called M87. Now that black hole is very, very, very large, and in this study they have actually made a picture of the black hole at the center of our galaxy, which is called Sagittarius A star. For a comparison, the black hole that they originally pictured was 1,600 times more massive than the one at the center of our own galaxy, so ours is a bit of a dwarf in comparison, but it's more of a normal black hole in terms of size.
Right.
And if you've seen the picture, it looks like a donut, an orange donut, with a black hole in the middle, not surprisingly. But again, to get the scale, the original black hole, you could fit the entire solar system into the hole in the middle.
Oh.
In this one, it's much smaller. You could maybe fit the orbit of Mercury, which is the closest planet to the sun, inside the black hole, but that's about it.
So okay, is it like kind of less, to me at least, it's less terrifying because space honestly scares me. So this is kind of a nice comparative black hole in terms of how small it is, because I genuinely do not want to go anywhere near it.
I mean, it's unlikely that you will.
That is probably.
But yeah. It's still a pretty terrifying place. It'll do horrible things to you if you get too close. But this image, it's really sort of groundbreaking because it is because it was incredibly difficult to obtain this picture. The first image, they were looking out of the plane of the galaxy into another galaxy, a relatively unobstructed view, the data for the current image was recorded at about the same time, but it's taken this long to process the data and figure out how to make it look like a picture of a black hole. And the difficulty was, you know, you're looking towards the center of our own galaxy, there's stars and dust and all sorts of things obscuring our view. This isn't an optical image, this is using radio waves that are about a millimeter long, so it penetrates through the dust and they can see through it and see what's in the background.
Wow.
And in order to take this picture, they've used what's called the Event Horizon Telescope. And you've probably all got a picture in your head of what a telescope looks like. First of all, this is a radio telescope, so maybe your picture changes and you see a dish on a big sort of big radio dish. The Event Horizon Telescope is about the size of our planet. Okay, so they calculated some time ago that in order to get a picture of this black hole, the size of the dish that you would need would have to be about the diameter of our planet. Okay?
That's insane.
So obviously they didn't build a telescope that's the diameter of our planet, but they've effectively assembled a telescope that is that diameter by using radio telescopes at different points on the globe.
Wow.
And that's piecing smart. Together all their pictures to finally get this sort of image.
Mm.
It's been a technologically massive challenge, but they've done it. They've seen the black hole, and now they can learn a lot more about it. They've already, you can see the stars orbiting the black hole very, very fast as they sort of as they spin around it, and so they've already estimated how big they think it should be, and it turns out with this image it fits the mark. It hits the mark perfectly, effectively.
Wow.
And so they can learn a lot more about our own galaxy and what's in the middle.
I'm looking at the photo right now, and it looks like a big orange donut with a bit of light. And I'm kind of like, okay, well, it doesn't look like a big deal, but it is actually a really, really impressive feat.
It is an incredibly impressive feat. If you imagine imaging a donut, an actual donut, on the surface of the moon, that's effectively what they've done. So if you imagine you put a donut, what's the size of your hand, on the surface of the moon, and they can image it with, you know, it's a bit blurry, but it's part of the reason it's blurry, interestingly, because the gas that's going around it is traveling so fast, it actually spins in a matter of a few hours. And as it's spinning, as the gas is spinning around this black hole, it's getting so hot, it's emitting radio waves, it's emitting light, and that's why we can see it.
Impressive. Some really exciting news in the world of science, which is obviously our theme for Dear Science, I hope. But the next one's not so nice. Potentially, species names could perpetuate gender bias, and I don't know what it's like. I know you've probably seen all the memes about, you know, women in STEM. It's not a great time to be a woman in STEM. But, potentially how we name species could kind of recreate that bias.
Well, I mean, I don't think this is very surprising, but a parasitologist at the University of Otago called Robert Poulin has combed through a bunch of studies published in 8 prominent parasitology journals over the last 20 years. And they were looking at discoveries of new species and what they were named. And it turns out, maybe not surprisingly, that these new species tended to be named after men or male scientists or best friends or people who just worked on the site or whatever. And only about, 18% of those, the new species in this field of parasitology in the last 20 years were named after women. And that probably reflects the proportion of men and women in that field. Mm-hmm. It reflects, I guess, the people who are working in the field. But I think this is just an alert to say, hey, let's think a bit more carefully about who we are immortalizing when we name these species. So parasites in particular are being discovered at a rate that's probably higher than most other species. So we're not discovering many new birds or mammals at the moment. Mm. But parasites, apparently we are. So in the last year, so the 20 plus new species were discovered. So it's fertile ground to see how they're being named. Yeah. Not surprisingly, people like Charles Darwin have had a bunch of things named after him. Other prominent male, usually scientists, have had a bunch of species named after them. But maybe it's about time we are thinking more and more about the gender bias in STEM. We need to be immortalizing women as much as we are men.
Would you want to be named after a parasite?
That's a very good point.
But
maybe if you devoted your career or if you were integral in helping find that particular species,
I guess to some people, if your lasting legacy was that you've been named after a parasite, I don't know if you'd love that personally.
Someone probably loves parasites.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Enough, yeah.
They're loved.
And our last topic for today, coronavirus ghosts. And that sounds kind of scary. It sounds a bit freaky. But basically, is this kind of like another case of a long COVID type thing?
Yes, it is.
Right.
So people more and more are talking about long COVID. And it seems to be a virus. The coronavirus seems to be a virus that, in a lot of people, causes these lingering after effects. Mm. And they can be very severe, and they can last for many months or longer. It's not clear how long they can last because the virus hasn't been around that long. But they can be debilitating, and it's not, you know, 1 in 1,000 people. It's more like, you know, 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 people who get these lingering effects.
Wow.
And so scientists have been trying to figure out, you know, what's causing them. Is there actually reservoirs of coronavirus left lingering somewhere in the body? And these are these ghosts that this article is referring to. And in this particular study, the scientists are looking at whether long COVID could be linked to viral fragments that are found in the gut. And just I don't know, hiding out and causing, you know, slowly causing havoc even after the main infection and the sort of the acute infection has been as it's gone.
I think anecdotally, a lot of people have kind of reported that after getting COVID, they've just felt awful. Even like after the virus is supposedly gone from their body, they're not testing positive anymore. They've just kind of felt very bit shit, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And it's, you know, the description of long COVID is when symptoms linger beyond 12 weeks, about 3 months after the initial infection. And more than 200 symptoms have been associated with the disorder, which range in severity from mild to completely debilitating. Mm. And there are a lot of theories about the origins. Early hints that the coronavirus might persist in the body came in 2021 in studies by gastroenterologists. And in those studies, it was clear that cells lining the gut displayed the protein that the virus uses to enter the cells. So this was allowing SARS-CoV-2, the COVID virus, to infect the guts. And the team found viral nucleic acids and proteins in gastrointestinal tissues collected from the people who'd been diagnosed with COVID-19 an average of 4 months earlier. So this was common. That they could find these viral fragments or nucleic acids in the guts of people, even 4 months after the initial infection. They found that antibodies produced by these by B cells, which are cells in our immune system, were continuing to evolve, suggesting that at 6 months after the initial infection, the cells were still responding to molecules made by SARS-CoV-2.
Right.
So
is there kind of like any research out there that kind of helps you avoid that? Any tips?
I know there are medications. There's antiviral medications being used in the States that seem to be effective at just wiping out the virus just everywhere in your body. I don't think we have them here.
Yeah.
The concern for a lot of people, and this is growing in the research community, is that there's going to be a generation of people who are unable to, you know, function or unable to work to their, you know, at 100% capacity.
And we're still not sure how long this will last.
It could be months, it could be years, it could be longer.
Wow.
And so there could be a lingering societal impact. You know, this is the danger of, I guess, of letting COVID loose, which effectively it is here now. Yeah. And in most countries it is, you know, you're playing a little bit of a risky game, because then in 5 years there could be, I don't know, 5% of your workforce who isn't able to work properly.
Yeah, scary. You can't really consider the pandemic is over at this point, because
not
it's really...
for a long time.
Not for a long time. Yeah. Well, on a slightly depressing note, that was Dear Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.